Tuesday, April the 2nd, Lyndon was up very early for the Congressional Leadership Breakfast. It's almost as though his decision had not lightened his days, but accelerated them. He went into the family dining room about 8:30 with the Vice President and Senator Long and Mike Mansfield and Robert Byrd and Speaker McCormick, the Postmaster General and Barefoot and Mike and Hale Boggs and Carl Albert. And I worked at my desk with Marilyn Waltz. And then, about 9:30, went down into the East Hall to meet the Ladies Committee of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. I had had a letter from Mrs. Smith, their president. They'd already arranged for an early morning tour of the White House, and she told me how much they had enjoyed seeing me, several of them, on the Today Show. And they hoped that, if you are in residence at that time, you may be willing to say just a brief hello. It was an example of a persuasive letter, and there's nothing I enjoy doing more than showing people the art in the White House. And so I'd asked them for coffee and sweet rolls at 9:30. It was a very pleasant hour. I showed them the Lincoln Room and the Queen's Room and the Treaty Room, quite taking it away from the guides. And we talked about the acquisitions in the last 4 years and those that I very much hoped might come in the remaining 9 months. They were an elegant, refined group of ladies, and I enjoyed them. And I think they enjoyed the intimacy of our visit. One of them, when I mentioned wanting a Copley, or was it a West, said she had one at home, but it was a portrait of one of our ancestors. Then I went back to my desk and had a goodbye visit with Jeanette Simmons. It is much wiser for her to return to her home in Longview since we've made this decision. And then I had a 2-hour session on our Woman Doers luncheon, going over my speech, underlining, making a few changes, reading at least 3 times, and always, always that frantic feeling that I've bitten off more than I can chew, as Aunt Effie would say, that I haven't given myself time enough to practice, study, steep myself, do my very best in whatever it is. And then I went over the seating, sent some word to Bess, and then at 12:30 put on my Molly Parnas suit, the white wool with brown trim, and went down to the Red Room for a photo with members of the National Association for Retarded Children. The poster child was Joey Belgi, a very lively, bouncy little boy, and his parents, the usual members of the Retarded Children's Association, the congressman from whose district he comes, James Hanley. We did pictures there and out on the balcony, and then finally, one of just me and Muriel, which was hardly the place for any real talk. Just, I guess we'll miss those good bowling games, and a laugh and a squeeze, and it was time to go in for the Women Doers Luncheon. This one was designed to accent what this administration has done for child health. From government, it was Mrs. Wilbur Cohen, whose husband was Secretary of HEW, and Jane Wirtz, wife of the Secretary of Labor, who has herself done so much work with the physically handicapped in equipping them for jobs. And the wives of 2 congressmen, Mrs. George Bush of Texas and Miss Jeffrey Cohelan of California, who were both nurses. Actually, there are 20 wives of congressmen who are nurses. And Mrs. Winthrop Rockefeller, wife of the governor of Arkansas, who's worked for years on mental health, effectively and energetically. And most of the guests were divided between heads of organizations related to health, professionals, and volunteers. The organizations ranging from the March of Dimes, the Association on Mental Health, and the Association for Retarded Children, and the National Congress of Parents and Teachers, the Urban League's Division of Health and Welfare, and the American Dietetic Association. Probably the largest group were the professionals, with such stars as Dr. Helen Taussig of Blue Baby fame, and professionals from the field of nutrition, nursing, science, and every branch of medicine. But my favorite group of the guests were, I think, the volunteers, because they can reach so many more of us. They are potentially a bigger labor force, and they are the ones that, in a way, this luncheon was designed to reach, to attract for more service, that plus spreading the word of what this administration has done. There were lots of volunteers for work in retarded children, most perhaps in Head Start, some in lesser known work like cystic fibrosis. I had asked a few special friends who act as hostesses and mix and mingle and get everybody to know each other, one at least for each table. My always reliable Libby Cater, and Matilda Krim, who had helped on every aspect of this, working with us on the guest list, primed to start the questions afterward, She already knew many of the professionals and would see that they met the government people. And there were writers on the subject of health, Dr. Phyllis Wright, the Ladies' Home Journal. It was very pleasant to have old friends like Dr. Bernice Moore from the Hogg Foundation at the University of Texas, whom I've known for 20 years or more, and Gertie Moss, whom I'd met about this time last year on our wonderful trip into the hills of North Carolina. Who should know more than she about the health of underprivileged children? And nobody enjoyed the luncheon more, I believe. And Jean Robicheaux, who used to write a column with Liz 25 years ago here in Washington, who now, because of a child who's nearly blind, is doing volunteer work for children with poor vision. There were many well-known names in this circle. Dr. Leona Baumgartner, Harvard, a sort of dean in health for children. Dr. Mary Calderoni was formerly a director of Planned Parenthood, and this was just the right time to ask Mrs. Milton Gordon, the Children's Committee of New York City, whose organization had given me a very generous award for my work in Head Start. And another guest was Dr. Belinda Strait, psychiatrist, whose mother is the very bulwark of the Senate Ladies Red Cross, and a woman for whom I have a very special regard. And, as always, the wife of the White House Fellow, assigned to this department, is Timothy Worth. I want these young White House fellows and their wives to go home attuned to what this administration is trying to do. So at every event, particularly a sort of working event like this one, we try to include the appropriate ones. So the receiving line finished in the red room. Muriel had stood with me. We went into the state dining room for sherry or orange juice, and then into the blue room, which is just right for 50 at round tables. Somewhere on my way, perhaps it was to the receiving line, I ran into Bess, who had on a pink eye patch. I couldn't stop the inevitable question, "What happened?" She laughed, "How like her? I had rather fight than switch." It was a pleasant, interesting luncheon. I had Mrs. Winthrop Rockefeller on my right, and Dr. Esther Clark, the chief speaker, about whose wonderful achievements in Palo Alto, California, in a clinic for children, I had read in the Saturday Evening Post, on my left, and also at the table, Mrs. Spencer Tracy, who herself had founded a clinic. And because I really wanted her to share the day, Gertie Moss, and another friend from Austin, Mrs. Bert Kruger Smith, whose work is with retarded children. Actually, retarded children and Head Start have got the most muscle power behind them of anything in the field of child health today, it seems. As soon as we had our coffee, I rose to make my little speech and hit it head on with, "Since last Sunday night, some of you may have been wondering whether we would be holding this luncheon. Let me say it clear and strong. We are going to be working until the day we leave this house on the programs we believe in. Actually, in the words of the young, I'm hooked for the rest of my life." Somewhat to my amazement, there was a resounding round of applause. I seldom get it when I talk. I don't know how, in the language, to milk it. And then I went on to describe what this administration has done in the field of health. Probably the brightest mark, Medicare for older people, then Medicaid for poor citizens, and perhaps closest to my husband's heart, Child Health Act of 67. His philosophy has always been that man can take and mold and change the ills that beset his society, and especially the problem of children whose lives are malleable and have so much promise for the future. And speaking of the value of research, I use a little story about Dr. Christian Barnard coming to the ranch and saying to Lyndon that he had received his training from one of our government grants at the University of Minnesota. And then I introduced Dr. Esther Clark, who gave us a brief, dramatic picture of the changes in childhood diseases over one generation. Even the names of those that used to kill so many have almost dropped from our vocabulary. And now we don't dread them anymore because of vaccines or drugs. And today, we have it in our power to produce superior human beings. But this will require a well-endowed environment. And then that led on the need for clean air and clean water and adequate nutrition and broader medical services. Next, I introduce Mrs. Charles Welch, sort of heads up the volunteers, the JC's Auxiliary, runs her organization from her kitchen, and has put thousands of women into volunteer health services, many of them connected with mental retardation and mental health. And then the last speaker, really the star, and I was so proud of her, was Muriel. And I hope I introduced her with all the warmth and admiration I feel. From a quiet, almost pedantic beginning, the impact of what she said mounted, and you felt a great empathy and understanding with her, with the whole problem of how you handle suddenly finding in your family close and crushing problem of a retarded child. We finished, I thought, on a high note. Then we had questions, which I passed on to our three speakers. It was a gratifyingly lively little session. I noticed Lucy's hand up and a couple of times turned to someone else, and she would gravely, hopefully, hold it up again. So then I pointed at her, and she rose and came to the rostrum. I should never be surprised at Lucy. Launched into a small, modest speech, she had had a somewhat disadvantaged childhood, and it was miraculous that she had escaped the flower children and hippie stage. She'd had a visual problem, was not detected until she was in high school, and it was rather frustrating. People would tell me I was a bright child and I worked hard, but I never knew what success was. For years and years, I lived in a family filled with success, and I never tasted it. And then she went on. Her eye problem had been found and corrected by a wonderful man, Dr. Kreskin. And her grades had jumped in 1 year from a D to a B minus. Then, as a freshman at Georgetown School of Nursing, she got a B plus. For the first time in my life, I knew what it was like to achieve. And she went on. Who knows? If this had not been corrected, I might have been a psychological dropout as well, with a lot of the problems that go with that. I heaved a sigh of relief when she sat down, but everybody seemed to love it. In the words of one newspaper woman, Lucy Agues took the ball and ran with it, and it was certainly the liveliest women doers luncheon we've had, except for Eartha Kitt. Dr. Clark herself turned to me and said, quite generously, "Your daughter was the star." Actually, I felt a little annoyed about her, as well as proud, because today it was for the real achievers, Dr. Clark, Muriel, now volunteer Mrs. Welch. I stood at the door and said goodbye. Then, by 3:30, it was back up on the second floor. With a lightened heart and something of a sense of achievement and release, gathered up my belongings and went to the airport, boarded the Meriwether. Liz was with me. Found the George Hartzogs already there. And Robin, Angie was coming later. And Mr. and Mrs. Dudley, he's Mrs. Post's suave and apparently quite influential with her lawyer. The trip was lightened by an amusing passing out of gifts, including an Easter rabbit about 3 feet high that I was to take home to Patrick. The plane was elegantly appointed and elegantly served, full of flowers and food brought from Hillwood. And on the outside, the flags of all the countries that it had visited were painted, some 30, I believed. And the motors, Rolls Royce, which set the whole tone. Somewhere along the way, we heard a radio report that the Senate had okayed the 10% income tax rise. And I felt a corresponding lift of heart. Maybe Lyndon's announcement of Sunday night. We'll jar loose the Congress and even some peace talks. We arrived at Palm Beach a little past 7, and as we descended, there was a cameraman. Lightheartedly, I didn't mind. I got into Mrs. Post's lovely big car, and we drove to Mar-a-Lago, which means between lake and sea. As we approached the gate, to my amazement, there was a loud honk, surprising in this elegant setting, but apparently it either caused the gate to open or Mrs. Post to emerge. There was indirect lighting, and I could see the palms soaring skyward, and there was Mrs. Post at the door, calm and regal, the last of the queens, in a setting that probably will not continue or be duplicated in this country in the lifetime of my children. She was gracious and charming, but had completely the air of one used to command. She took me directly to my room. She told me I was to have her daughter Dina Merrill, now Mrs. Cliff Robertson's room, and that she considered it the prettiest ones of the guest suites. And when I stood at the door, I thought, I am once more in the bower of the fairy princess. But this one is a very young princess. The room was pink and blue, delicate and fragile, great sprays of flowers and bas-relief across the walls. I think they were dogwood. The bed was canopied in blue taffeta, rising to a little crown at the top. And the light fixtures themselves were tiny crayons, around the edge of which hung corkscrew curls. The most delightful thing of all was that Mrs. Post said she first brought her small daughter, she was about 6 or 7, I gathered at that time, into the room she had created for her. That Nina looked up at her and said, "Oh, Mother, I'm such a lucky little girl," which, after 30 years or more, still pleased her, just as it did me. And she took me in my bathroom. There, all around the wall, were tiles, gay, amusing representations of Jack B. Nimble and Humpty Dumpty, and all the familiar characters from Mother Goose. And Mrs. Post said, in those days you could buy these in New York. I gathered she meant they weren't custom made, but they don't do such things anymore. She left me and a maid came in. I dressed quickly, because I'd gotten the impression that one was on time for dinner in this house. And I emerged almost on the dot of 8:30 in my flowered Adele Simpson with a green Alaskine coat, finding my way through terraces and hall to a great breathtaking room that I can only compare in my experience to San Simeon. Night, there was only the household for dinner, those of us on the plane. Besides Mrs. Post, Mrs. Voigt, who I gathered was her secretary friend, the housekeeper. A very elegant, exotic blonde woman with the unlikely name of Gladys Johnston. We had one drink, and I feel that that's rather what one does here, not a prolonged period. And like a crab, my eyes tried to look in all directions at once. To the unbelievably magnificent ceiling that looked like gold sunbursts, the coats of arms of the Doges of Venice around the wall. I was told that the enormous rug was Spanish and had come from an old monastery, that the hooded fireplace at one end of the room was big enough to accommodate logs to the length of railroad ties. There were flowers everywhere, orchids, in luxurious arrangement. And on a large table behind the sofa, an array of chiefs of state who had been her friends. And one jarring note was the family of the Lyndon Johnsons, framed in a simple brown wood. I made a mental note to get the handsomest picture in evening dress that Lyndon and I had, framed in gold and matted in velvet, and send it on my return, hoping that she will send this family picture, if anywhere, to her lodge in the Adirondacks. An especially fitting note, I thought, it's a painting on the wall of Lorenzo the Magnificent, no less, in full splendor on his horse, and very much at home here. It was a huge tiger-skin rug on the raised floor of a nick. And Mrs. Post herself quoted a limerick that went something like, "Would you like to sin on a tiger skin, or would you rather err on another kind of fur?" Quite promptly, we went out on the terrace and were seated at round tables in a setting whose elegance and grace and opulence I shall probably never see repeated. We looked out through a series of arches onto the great smooth lawns that led to, I'm not sure whether this was the side of the sea or of the lake. The stone looked more like 4 centuries than 40 years, so mellowed it was. I was told that a Viennese sculptor, Franz Barwig, his son, had spent 2 years designing and carving the Doria stone from Genoa into the infinite patterns of birds, grapes, and scrolls, and flowers. There was a different bird on every column, a pelican, a parrot. The walls were covered with old Spanish tiles, some 36,000 that had been collected in Spain 75 years ago, but were, in fact, several centuries old. And against them, there were pots of flowers, huge ferns, tropical plants, and amazingly and delightfully, a common old friend, the hollyhock, about 8 feet tall, pretty pink blossoms by the dozens, most dressed-up hollyhocks I ever saw. Later, I heard there was one gardener whose sole job it is to take care of the house plants. In fact, he must be a very busy man. The meal was delicious and exquisitely served. The only thing I missed was that I really couldn't talk to our hostess. She is so very deaf, and you never know whether she hears what you say or not. What interesting stories she must have to tell. I would have loved to really get to know her better. Redcarth was attentive and at hand at every step. It is easy to understand the role that he fills in her life, which revolves so much around dinners and house parties. I asked Redcarth about his children, particularly Fritz Allen. That was a funny little moment in the evening. He said, "Well, tonight He's out in Wisconsin, where he's been working on the primary. I felt a warmth of thanks and a pang for all those troops who had so suddenly lost their cause. And Fred and I reminisced about how long ago he had started campaigning for Lyndon, about Amon Carter and Fort Worth. After coffee, we walked out onto the terrace, which was patterned in pebbles, ranging from every shade of tawny beige through creamy white to black. Mrs. Post was with me and told me that she had picked up a pocketful of these pebbles on the beach, I think she said, at Long Island, and that she and her husband, Ed Hutton, had told the architects how they wanted them laid out to make the court a patio, and then they had been brought down by carloads. What a vast construction venture it must have been. It took 4 years and was finished in January 27. But there was work still going on when the crash came in 28, and advisors told Mrs. Post she ought to stop. She said no indeed, Palm Beach needed it more now than ever. So she went right on, giving employment to many with works on the surrounding grounds and houses. Got the message somehow. It was quite all right to be an early evening. So it must have been about 10:30, certainly not later than 11. I said good night, then went in to the bower of the Fairy Princess. I'd ask if they had a copy of Nicholas and Alexandra. My own I could not find when I left. They did, and I read myself to sleep in what I thought a peculiarly ironic and appropriate for this tragic and excellent book.